Very topical now.
ויקום מלך חדש על מצרים.
Oh, yes. Very, very.
Right, okay. So obviously, for Egypt, having a new king is not a new thing at all.
They have no more time, yeah.
Right, so where we got up to last time, looking at this Sedra Shemot, we got up to verse 11. What it says in verse 10 is about the fear of the king. The king is afraid of the Jewish people. What will happen if there's a war and then they will be added to our enemies and fight against us? So in other words, they were frightened of the Jews as a potential fifth column. Now all the time when we're
even worse, yeah. Driving us from the land.
Yeah, driving us from the land, you're quite right. Driving, well, an effective fifth column, yeah. And you see, all the time when we're reading this, we have in mind at least two different pictures. One is the historical events of the Jewish people in Egypt 3,000 and something years ago. And the other is the whole idea of the personal Egypt. Yes. The way in which there is Mitzrayim, Egypt, which can be written Meitzarim, limitations. And so the internal exile of the individual within a personal state of limitations. Now, the sages talk about different levels of this limitation. And one level is the Yetzer Hara, the evil desire. The evil desire is a tremendous limitation in a person's life. Just, looking at, life stories, different things that happen, the way in which some negative desire within a person's life in fact turns into something unfortunately very destructive for that individual in some way. Then they manage to break out of it, they restrain it, or they transform the situation, but it's a tremendous struggle. But there are higher levels of Egypt as well. There is even the Egypt of holiness. You see, whatever level one is on, spiritually, one has come, one has worked, one has strived to reach a certain spiritual level, but that itself can become a limitation. That itself can become a mitzrayim. And one has to be able to leave that as well. And so there's always this process of moving forward, of going beyond limitation. So maybe when we're looking at the story, we can try to see aspects of this private psychological story as well as the historical story. All right, so first of all, we have the threat. Pharaoh thinks that the Jews are likely to be a threat. And then we have verse 11. Millie, would you like to read that? Vayasimu alav.
וישימו עליו שרי ניסים למען ענותו בסבלותם, ויבן ערי מסכנות לפרעו אל פתאום ואת רמסס. וכאשר יענו אותו כן ירבה וכן יפרוץ, ויקוצו מפני בני ישראל. To continue?
Would you like to translate?
וישימו עליו, and the...
No, read the English.
The Egyptian appointed.
Where is it?
11.
Millie would rather...
Sorry. Oh. I'm going to try myself. Yeah, the Egyptian appointed conscription officer over the Israelites to crush their spirits with hard labor. The Israelites were to build up the cities of Pitom and Ramses as supply centers for Pharaoh. But the more the Egyptian oppressed them, the more the Israelite proliferated and spread. The Egyptian came to dread the Israelites.
Yes, you said that. Vayakutsu mipnei bnei Yisrael. Now, it's interesting, this force the Egyptians. You know, one thing is Egypt, but then you have the Egyptians themselves, Paro. Paro, the word Paro, if we just look at the letters.
It's the name itself, Pharaoh.
Sorry?
Which is Pharaoh, the Egyptian rulers, did they work hard? Do you think they were lazy?
That's an interesting thing, because Paro actually, there is this midrash that he had a brick in front of him, and he would say that he is working as well. You know, he claimed to be working as well. But let's just see the name of Paro.
Gematria.
Right, we have here two words. One is Paro. What's the second word?
Ha'oref.
What does Ha'oref mean? The back of the neck.
Yeah.
The back of the neck. Paro is seen in Hasidic texts as the constriction from the mind to the heart. You see, when we're speaking about limitation, there's the mind, there's the possibilities of the mind thinking about beautiful things, spiritual things, but then there's the question whether that ever reaches the heart. And Paro is the constriction, is the back of the neck, which doesn't let it reach there. So in other words, there are forces inside us. And I'm extending this now from Paro himself to the Egyptians as a whole, that there are forces inside us which work in a negative way as regards our real deeper well-being. Now the forces might be desires, might be selfishness, might be self-aggrandizement, all the negative qualities that we might depict in terms of analyzing a character or our own character can be seen as these negative forces. For example, Amalek. Amalek is a famous negative source within the person. Amalek is later on in the Torah, in the book of Exodus. But let's just see. Here we actually have a gematria. Ayin is 70. What's mem?
40.
And lamed?
30.
And kuf?
100.
Right. Now, then we have another word.
Safek,
yes, doubt. Samach is
15.
60. Pei is 80.
And 100.
Okay, so let's see. This is 1740 is 110. And
240.
And this is 60 and 80 is 140. 240. Right, so they're both 240. So Amalek and Safek and doubt have the same numerical value. So when someone is enthusiastic and they're determined to do something good, you know, there's a plan to set up some wonderful tzedakah institution or something positive. And then the person who a minute ago was feeling this enthusiasm suddenly starts to have doubts about it. Well, on one level, you know, you need to look at all the downside and so on in order to plan it properly. But there is a way in which the coldness of doubt overcomes a person and they prefer not to do anything. And the other person says, oh, come on, you know, we'll make it work. And so this is this power to dampen. That is Amalek. The Jewish people had come out of Egypt with a tremendous, you know, who in the Middle East and Mesopotamia hadn't heard of this amazing event with these plagues, every month another plague, and then finally this killing of the firstborn and leaving Egypt, and then the destruction of the Egyptians at the Red Sea. Incredible, absolutely incredible. And just after that came Amalek. So Amalek, they are the ones who, in the midst of the enthusiasm, when everyone was really ready to say, you know what, can you manage? The Jewish people are, you know, that they've really, God is on their side, we've got to respect this, they're a sacred people. Amalek says, come on, let's get them. And so that power of doubt inside one, that's an example of a kind of negative force which is in the person. Now, I'm suggesting that if we come back to Paro ha'oref, the back of the neck, also restricting, it's a different nuance. He's restricting the beginning of the excitement because you have the cerebral idea, but it's just an idea. He doesn't want it to even get to the level of becoming an excitement because he just wants to keep it as something cerebral, but life is going to go on and before as before. No one's going to have to get up 5 minutes earlier. Don't worry. Nothing will change. Nothing will change. It's not going to be different. And so that's Paro. And then you have the Egyptians. The Egyptians who look on the Jews with fear, and the way the Jews are expanding. In other words, there's this positive force within oneself. And then there's the opposite force. As you always have, you know, you have centrifugal force and centripetal force, you know, so you always have these opposites. And we are the ones struggling with both of these inside us. Now we then have a very interesting verse, Shaul, that's verse 13.
Right.
Do you want to translate that?
The Egyptians started to make the Israelis do labor designated to break their bodies.
Right. Now that you see, that's the thing, befarech, designated to break their bodies. And one of the commentaries, let's just see whether we have it actually in Rashi over here.
No,
it's not actually the pyramid. As far as we know, it's
a place.
Yes.
Now, one of the
is it a Yiddish word, Parech?
People might say Avodas Parech in Yiddish, but it's a quote from Yisrael.
No, because on a different level, we know this is Hebrew.
Probably as well.
But Shaul reminded me that as kids we used to hear Jerusalem.
The kid is called the kids of the Natura Karta, Mishigene Aparech.
Why would it, what did it mean?
The kids called the kids of Natura Karta, or the other way around?
No. Our kids,
yes.
The Natura Karta.
That's how they mocked.
Yeah.
We were mocking them, but Aparech, I thought it's a ball, no? Because it used to...
There's Pere Adam.
No, but we used to say Mishigene. I mean, I used to hear. I never did it, but I never heard. Mishigene Aparech. This is what they used to say.
Yeah. Okay, I'm not sure. We have to investigate.
It's a Jerusalem.
It's a Yiddish word.
But there is a lot of Jerusalemite. I mean, there is actually a book that came out with all those sayings.
Jerusalem slang.
It's so
in Yiddish.
Yeah. It's so different.
What do you mean, Jerusalem slang?
Only Jerusalem, because it goes back, and it's all sorts of different languages in it as well. From Ladino to Mugrab to this to that.
Okay.
But Parak is hard labor, you know.
Yeah, Parak is hard labor, but we're going to have a further comment on it. Nigel, would you like to read this?
Which one?
This thing in a, like in the dark box.
In the colored one.
Dark box.
Yeah.
A closer look with backbreaking labor. When the Egyptians saw that constricting the Jews to build storage cities did not succeed in checking their birth rate, they added mental demoralization to the hard work in order to break their spirits, correctly believing that this would weaken them physically as well. First, they made the men do women's work and the women to do men's work. The change in routine was unsettling. Both the men and the women found themselves ill-suited to one another's jobs. The women weren't strong enough to do the men's work, even though the women were required less raw strength in men's work. The endurance it requires was more than the men were capable of. Secondly...
Right, okay, let's take it one at a time. So that's very interesting. Now this is something the Talmud tells us. That this word beparech means... You see, the idea is that it's hard work. So there's different kinds of hard work. One is back-breaking labor, terrible hard work. But then there's more subtle hard work. Making the men do what the women do, and the women do what the men do, is psychologically taking a person off their guard, taking them, unbalancing the person. And
unless they're a movie star or something.
Mm-hmm.
That's Dustin Hoffman or something.
Okay.
Secondly, instead of having them build storage cities, they made them do work without purpose, simply for the sake of afflicting them. This was particularly demoralizing, for even if a person is forced to work hard, he can at least pride himself on having done the job well if there is a specific objective. But if there's no objective and the work has no end, it's both physically and mentally back-breaking.
Right, so now that is another explanation of Befarech. The hard work means that it was meaningless work. I once heard this story.
To do something like to torment somebody.
Yes, to torment them that they were doing building work, for example, which was completely meaningless, and the buildings were demolished the next day, or something like that. I once heard this story that there was a man who was in prison. And all
Sisyphus. His labor.
Well, Sisyphus, rolling that's the, right. He's the, rolling the stone up, and then the stone rolls down.
Again, the next day up again.
Then he, that's certainly an image of meaningless work, but he knows at that moment that it's meaningless.
Mm.
But the Israelites in Egypt did not do meaningless work.
Sorry?
The Israelites in Egypt.
Well, one of the explanations of Befarech is that it was meaningless.
But
work.
They did say that they...
Here it says that they were building
actually,
store cities.
Yes.
But there's a midrash which says it wasn't proper store cities. They weren't building in a proper way. They were building things that would get demolished again or something like that. The wider picture is that it was actually meaningless.
It's interesting, because I always think if it's more meaningless to make something that's meaningful people you don't like. Like, at least if you're building a great temple for your, when you're being slave, why would you want to do that?
All right, that's a very interesting thing. But there were Jews who had to work for the Nazis doing various things.
Why would you?
Bridge and the River Kwai.
Well, the bridge and the River Kwai is very interesting because...
That was necessary.
As it was presented, the people building it got so involved with the project that they wanted then to protect it against harm from their own allies who wanted to to knock it down.
That's true. But
you know, so they lost the plot, and they became so devoted to the task. I remember there's a very, very moving, you know, there's this series called The Holocaust Memoirs, where it's actually something that was put in motion from Lakewood Yeshiva, or families of people involved in Lakewood, which is a Torah studying community in America. So they got involved with people who are Holocaust survivors and writing their story. And many of these books, it's a whole series, 15, 20 volumes. Each one is fascinating in its own right. So one of them is called Counterfeit Lives. And it's about people who were put to work printing counterfeit banknotes, English banknotes. And the banknotes were then dropped in like thousands over England with the idea of weakening the British currency. I've actually seen some of these banknotes. Someone I know has a collection of them. He got some. So there, the person is involved in doing a project for the people he hates, as Nigel says, quite rightly. And the terrible thing was the success. If they could have stymied this in some way, if they could have introduced some error into the banknote so that it would be obvious. But according to the way this book went, you know, they didn't attempt that. Whereas there might be other people in other situations doing slave labor, where they would try to sabotage what they were doing. There certainly have been such instances. But here, the Jews didn't have any reason to hate the Egyptians. It's the Egyptians who hate the Jews. The Jews were perfectly happy in Egypt. They came there. There was a country that allowed them to come in. And so they're perfectly happy building store cities, as it says in the Pshat,
But in the actual Torah, it's written, "Vayeven arenis kenot leparoit pitom beit Ramses." So they were actually building those pyramids or whatever they were.
The store cities.
That's what they are.
Don't forget, the pyramids are tombs. And as I understand, the pyramids actually predated the Jewish people.
So what is Arei Miskanot?
Store cities.
What does it mean?
Storage.
Like
big forts. Silos, storage. Big sheds.
Storage, mahzanim. So you think that the pyramids predated the Jewish
story? I think so. I heard that.
It's not my field, but I heard
archaeological discoveries later.
Someone told me that by the time we have this pharaoh, the Egyptians had forgotten what the pyramids actually were. And said, like, there were the pyramids, but they didn't really know what they
funny
were.
Funny, that's the meaning. Ramesses was an Egyptian pharaoh, one of the pyramids was for Ramesses. He was already dead and there was already a town in his name, so must have.
But there were a few Ramesses.
Yeah,
that could be. Yeah, there were many. There were many leaders called Ramesses. Yeah. It's interesting that the Targum, when it says Pitom and Ramses, now, one second. Here it says, it gives different names. The Targum Yonatan says Tanis and Pilusin. Instead of Pitom and Ramses, it says Tanis. Now, Tanis is spelled in English T-H-A-N-E-S. If you've ever been to the British Museum, there's a lot of stuff there from Tanis, from Thames, T-H-A-N-E-S. And that is identified in the second Targum, calling it Tanis, and Pilusin, which I don't know of, but that's like another town. So it's identifying where they are. It's identifying what they are. But this idea, first of all, of a kind of confusion. You know, this hard work, we're here dealing with, when we're talking on the inner psychological level, we're talking about the breakdown of a person's personality in some sense. And there's this sense of confusion. The male, the female, it's... And the lack of meaning, the sense that, you see, you might be doing something which is very meaningful, but you don't understand the meaning.
Yeah.
A child, a 14-year-old doing homework, so you can explain to them what the meaning is. Listen, if you do this homework properly, then over a period of years, you then do your GCSE and you'll pass, you go to university, you got a whole future mapped out on the basis of sitting up 2 hours instead of going out to play, sitting or watching videos or something. You know, sitting and doing this maths homework or something, or geography. But for the child, it's just an excruciating torture. You know, why do I have to, or might be, why do I have to do this? So the question of meaning and meaninglessness is very much an interior issue. And the structure of approaching a person and helping a person develop is helping them develop their sense of meaning. But in Egypt, that sense of meaning was being demolished. So that's part of the inner destruction. The inner destruction taking place through the slavery in Egypt is a destruction of meaning. Now, Viktor Frankl is the famous logotherapist, psychologist, who was actually put in concentration camp himself. And he had developed, before he came into the camps, he had developed his system of logotherapy, which is based around the issue of meaning. What he calls a noetic neurosis is a neurosis where there is no meaning in the person's life. And he said that, you know, for some people, he doesn't say for everyone, but for some people, for a proportion of people, this is a very significant issue. He doesn't make a kind of a blanket claim. I would have thought that meaning is very important for everyone, but he's saying no, only a certain percentage. There are other people who don't care about meaning at all.
Hence, that's what capitalism is. Otherwise, you'd advertise different things. People buy products that are meaningless. A world advert, so there must be a market for it. Meaningless lives, I think.
Do you see meaningless? They might be consumers.
But what happens when you're selling products which you might say that people don't need? You create a need by advertising and various other cultural forces. You make a person feel that they are not a proper mensch if they don't have the latest edition of Windows on their computer.
You don't create a need, you create a want.
That's a significant difference. Absolutely.
What I want to ask is, why do you think the Torah said black and white? Because obviously not all Egyptians are evil and bad, and we just kind of almost delivered this racist kind of attitude towards the Egyptians, which is ludicrous. It's a big country, there's lots of different...
The Torah is not black and white.
I think in this instance it is. And when it comes to Abrahamic things, it's kind of there's 50 good people and there's one good person and then it's all right. And here it's just...
Egypt isn't only that moment. Egypt is also the Egypt where Joseph came and was able to save everybody.
But in the Egypt of this period of time, we also have differences. For example, there were people who kept telling Pharaoh that he should listen to what the Jews are saying. Don't you see it's the finger of God? The Torah is happy to say that Moses' name was very great in Egypt, in the land of Egypt, for the Egyptians. And there were the Egyptians, Hayare Edva Hashem, the Egyptian who feared God. And when they heard that the plague was coming, which would kill their cattle and horses, they took them away and hid them somewhere out of the plague of hail.
Okay, that didn't realize.
You know, so it's the Torah is very nuanced.
Okay.
And even great people in the Torah, very often it presents some negative aspect of them. They fall into some negative mode of behavior, you know, mysterious issue. So the Torah is very subtle.
Even Miriam, the great prophetess.
That's right. Miriam, at some point, who is such a wonderful person, who saved Moses and everything else, later on spoke against Moses in some sense, and as a result got leprosy. And what was her speaking against him? She was speaking against the fact that he wouldn't sleep with his wife, because he was in such an intense sacred high, he wouldn't sleep with his, he wouldn't be intimate with his wife. And so Miriam spoke about that with her brother Aaron, and that was criticized. And she got leprosy as a result for speaking again, you know, for saying anything negative about Moshe. And yet Moshe hit the rock as well, and so Moshe was condemned to die in the desert. And so the Torah always
nuances. That's not the reason he was condemned to die.
Well, no. So then,
I mean, it's
okay. It's an unrolling. I saw very, very interesting. You see, last week, last Shabbat, we had the giving of the Torah. And the Midrash Tanchuma, has a very interesting passage called Bevat Achat, at one go. And it starts going through a list of opposites. At the Bevat Achat, at the same time, God is Yotzer Or Uvore Choshech. God creates light, forms light and creates darkness. So you've got two opposites. He does good and he makes evil, from a verse in Isaiah. So he gives a string of such opposites, and then the possibility of all kinds of contrasting things happening in the world at the same time. So all this is happening at the same time. And there we have the concept of the giving of the Torah, which sort of is embracing opposites and unifying opposites, unifying the spiritual realm, the physical realm. And so the Torah, that's the mode of the Torah. That is the mode. So here we have, when we're looking at the inner story of Egypt, that's what we're trying to understand. We're looking at the book of Exodus, not just the outer story, but also the inner story. So the idea is that there is some kind of confusion within the person. And the confusion relating to this gender confusion today, I mean, unfortunately, could have been written for our time completely, where there's this tragic, tragic loss of a sense of gender on the public forum. And the idea that children should be given the opportunity to ascertain what are their, I can't remember the technical term that they use, you know, whether they're homosexual or lesbian, rather than helping people develop in a positive way. So this gender confusion dimension is strangely relevant to our society. But it's also there inside the individual. If we look at Mashpia and Makabel, the male is the one who gives, the female the one who receives, we all combine both these qualities. But if those qualities are confused, then we're not able to function properly. And so there we have this first dimension. Now, can we go on, please, with the next verse, verse 14. Vayimaru et chayehem 14. You've got the English. Would you like to read it in Hebrew and English, or both?
Alan?
I'm trying to see where it is.
It's verse...
It's the bottom of 14.
Oh, there we are. They made the lives of the Israelites miserable with harsh labor involving mortar and bricks, as well as all kinds of work in the field. All the work they made them do was intended to break them.
Right. Now, it's interesting, there was this hard work. Mortar and bricks in Hebrew is bechomer uvilavenim. And now there's a comment on this in the Midrash, which is picked up in Hasidic texts. Chomer. Does that remind you of something? Kal v'chom. Does anyone know what kal v'chom means?
Yes.
Hmm?
It's kal v'chomer. If this is that, the other one is definitely that.
Yes, that's right. Now, where is this used, this method of discussion?
In the Gemara.
Nigel is right. In the Gemara, in the Talmud. It is one of the methods of discussion in the Talmud that you say, if in the light case, the easy case, that's kal, such and such a condition applies, how much more in the severe case, which is chomer? Right? How much more? So there is a comparison. Actually, I think the Zohar says this. That the Egypt, one aspect of Egypt, is not being a slave. It's studying the Babylonian Talmud. Why? Because the Babylonian Talmud is the Talmud of Bavel, of confusion. B'machashakim hoshivani, he set me down in darkness, it says in the Book of Lamentations, in Eicha. And the Talmud comments, Ze Talmudo shel Babel. That's the Babylonian Talmud. And the person is struggling, arguing, looking at all the confusion that you have. The Mishnah says this, but then you have some other statement by the sages says the opposite. And you have Hillel says this, and Shammai says that, and the whole thing seems to be confused. And you're trying to work out what you are supposed to do. Now that's the next word. What's the next word? After Kal of Chomer? What's the word after Bechomer?
Bilavenim.
Now Bilavenim means with bricks. But the word Lavan means
white.
So there's a phrase, Libun Hilchata. Clarifying, whitening, like clarifying the halacha. The halakha is hidden. The actual legal teaching, what is the path that a Jew should follow, is hidden in these texts, one text on top of the other, and all these different traditions which contradict each other, and the different rabbis through the generations are arguing about it in the page of the Talmud. Then you have the commentators on the Talmud. Rashi says it means this. Tosfot says no, it means that. And then you have the Rishonim, the other early sages, and then later on other figures discussing. So it's this, all this is Libun Hilchata, getting the halacha clear. That's another dimension of Egypt. Because now in the time of Galut, that's the service of the Jew. The service of the Jew is to take this mass of Torah teaching, which is all jumbled up, and try to unravel it. So when Maimonides came along and wrote his Mishneh Torah, he said, I'm going to unravel the whole thing. It was like taking a sword and chopping through the Gordian knot. There's this raveled, this complex knot of Talmudic thought. Maimonides, who understood it all very clearly, he decided he's going to write the answers all down. And the Raivad, Rabbi Avram ben David of Poskier, and other people as well, how can you do such a thing? We've got to be unraveling the knots. you can't just tell us what the end is. Like the end of the detective story. And the Rambam wanted that there should be a clear statement of the halakha. That all you need to do, he said, is look in the Bible and then look at my book and you'll understand what the halakha is. But in the middle, and the consensus of opinion was against him, although he developed a new system of thought, which was the writing of poskim, the writing of halachic works, which led to Rabbi Joseph Caro's Code of Law in the 16th century. But nonetheless, the study of Talmud, the unraveling of these complex knots continued. And when they had finally managed to unravel all the knots, sometime around the 18th century, then began new approaches to Talmud, like the Lithuanian scholarship, which discovers philosophical dimensions and, further and further reaches of Talmudic exploration. But the Zohar says this is all like another subtle form of Egypt. Then, of course, you have the Kabbalistic way of looking at the Talmud, where a line of Talmud itself becomes a vehicle for a spiritual teaching. It is said of Rabbi Isaac Luria. Rabbi Isaac Luria, I think he was the nephew of a famous person called Rabbi Bezalel Ashkenazi, the Shita Mekubetzet. Shita Mekubetzet means Shita is path, collected pathways. Now, the collected pathways is a book that you can buy in a Hebrew bookstore today. And you say, the way you use it is, let's say you're studying a particular tractate, you open up the page, so there's an argument there. Shita Mekubetzet will give you the different ways of understanding the argument. This is Rashi's way, this is Tosfot's first way, this is Tosfot's second way. This is another commentator and another one. So you have all the different shitot, how to understand that page of Talmud. So it's said that Rabbi Isaac Luria would learn the page of Talmud seven ways. Six ways according to the different commentators and analysts, and the seventh way according to the Kabbalah. So that's another dimension of what we're speaking about here. That this inner Egypt, this inner dimension of Egypt can even be very sacred. It can be in the study hall. But it's still something that one is trying to reach out of and break into a higher, the Yetziat Mitzrayim, the going out of Egypt, the Exodus. All right, so now we have a dramatic event. That's verse 15, Vayomer Melech Mitzrayim. Yeah, you need the last two words at the bottom of page 22.
No, I'm looking at the wrong page. I'm looking at the last page of the whole thing.
Okay, yeah.
The
more confusing.
Lam Yadot Ha'ivriyot Ha'ivrit Asher Shem Ha'chat Shifra V'Shem Ha'shimit Pua. And the king of Egypt spoke to the chief Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shifa and Pua. Bayomer, I'll read it in English. He said, when you deliver Hebrew women, you must look carefully at the birth stool. If the infant is a boy, kill it. But if it is a girl, let it live.
Go on.
The midwives feared God and did not do as the Egyptian king had ordered them. They allowed the infant boys to live. The king of Egypt summoned the midwives and demanded, why did you do this? You let the infant boys live. The Hebrew women are not like the Egyptians, replied the midwives to Pharaoh. They know how to deliver. They can give birth before a midwife even gets to them. God was good to the midwife, and the people increased and became very numerous. Because the midwives feared God, he gave them great families of their own.
Right, okay, so let's stop there.
Chayot, ha'ivriyot, ki en chayot.
It's interesting.
But it really nails it.
Yes, yeah, it's a very powerful passage.
Yeah.
Now, it calls them the chief midwives because obviously there are hundreds of thousands of people. And they have to have like a whole team of midwives. This is a very interesting thing in terms of medicine and the Jewish people. So there was a team of midwives. I mean, the Midrash makes clear that we're talking about the leaders of a team. And these two women are the leaders of the team of midwives who are administering to the needs of the Jewish women. And here we have then the king who is telling them to kill every boy child who is born to a Hebrew woman. And they refuse. They don't openly refuse, but they refuse to do it. And when the king says to them, what happened? Why didn't you do it? Oh, by the time we get there, the woman's already given birth to the baby by herself. And in other words, as if midwives were redundant. Yes, there are some peoples where they don't use midwives. I seem to remember a certain Red Indian biography. It was organized by... I think there was an American woman who came very close with a particular tribe and helped members of this tribe sort of write their biography. And one of the books in this project opens with a scene where there is a woman who is about to give birth and she doesn't tell anyone. She's riding on a horse.
She goes into
the woods by herself and has the baby and then comes back with the baby. And it's all done in a completely private way. Whereas it seems that the Jewish people had a whole complex thing with midwives and chief midwives looking after them. But in order to get over the problem of Pharaoh wanting the boy children to be killed, so they said, no, they deliver themselves. Before we managed to get there, they've already had the child. Now, can we translate this into personal terms? How would we think of this? If we're talking about the inner Egypt, how would we see? What is this process of birth? And what is this attempt to stifle birth?
Renewal. Birth is renewal, so stifle birth is prevent renewal.
Right.
And if the midwife isn't there, you don't need to help us with self-renewal.
Mm-hmm. Would you say renewal or creativity? See, in terms of...
Yes, I would say renewal.
And in what sense renew?
Life renews itself, rebirth, in a way. Birth to continue life.
And so what's the force of the inner Pharaoh? To stifle it.
Oh, the inner Pharaoh, yes. It's to prevent people from...
progress?
Yeah, I mean, not so from developing.
From developing.
It could be...
So in other words, the idea of killing the male children, God forbid, is a metaphor for stifling the inner development of the person.
Well, I think it may have something to do with the way people used to think of how procreation works, in terms of the man putting the seed in the woman, and without the man, it isn't possible. So if you stop men from existing, then there will be no more renewal.
Aha.
But this may not necessarily be a Talmudic idea.
It'd be difficult to have renewal if there's no woman either, you know?
Very true.
It's interesting. I think of it in terms of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
The person who's afraid to create something, there's some force in him working against his own creative powers. Working against his own creative powers. And in this sense, the boy child versus the male child, it's like it's some kind of metaphor for...
self-renewal, in terms of renewal within oneself. So you reach a certain thingy and level, and then you have to become the next person go out of where you were and...
Mm. All right, well, I see that really as...
So the Egypt is fact that we are constraining our own selves.
Yes.
Our own creativity.
Yes. All renewal. It's, you see, the development and creativity really work together. Because
Egypt is mental slippers and fireplaces and not doing anything.
That's, yes, that's certainly a variety of Egypt.
Yes.
The person just wants to go on doing what they were doing yesterday.
Come home, sit in the armchair, read the paper,
no,
go to bed.
No progress. No,
nothing.
No,
just do the same thing. And the pension comes and the retirement age, they drop dead because they haven't learned to do anything else. Yeah.
Yes, so different. someone made some kind of casual survey of people in an airport. Now, if you look at people in an airport, you sometimes see people who are just like sitting. You know, they have to wait for their plane or something. They're just sitting. But Jews are always doing something. They might be eating, yeah. Or they're doing something else, but they're not just sitting.
That's why Ella lounges are very different to any other lounges you go to.
But so there is there was a Russian anti-Semite, I think his name was Rozanov, in the beginning of the 20th century. And quite, you know, interesting personal writings. I mean, it happens he was an anti-Semite. You know, a lot of his writing is not about Jews at all. But at one point he says, the Jews, always busy. He can't stand it. These Jews, these active Jews. Mm. And so here we have the Jews, you know, producing, having so many children. You know, it's a metaphor. You could say in terms of, you know, right, it's the historical reality of thousands of years ago, but in our own lives or in terms of cultural forces, it's this struggle of this creative, active Jewish people, and there is the Pharaoh which wants to destroy it. Now, the Pharaoh is also a force inside us, not wanting us to be, not wanting us to act in that kind of way, and wanting to stifle and to kill every boy child. And then, Michael, would you like to take the very last, have you got it? That's the last one we'll do today. Verse 22. You could read it in English.
Vayehi.
Pharaoh then gave orders to his people. It's on page 261.
Yeah, Pharaoh then gave orders to all his people. Every boy who is born must be cast into the Nile, but every girl should be allowed to live.
Yes, now that actually takes it beyond the Jewish people. He's telling everyone, every boy born has to be killed, has to be thrown into the Nile. And every girl should be allowed to live. And there's a sense in which this is also, in terms of the Jewish girls, the Israelite girls, this is forcing the girl into the Egyptian lifestyle, taking the Jewish girl, but allowing her to live, but on Pharaoh's terms. That's one of the ways this is analyzed.
But also the Egyptian boys, though. I mean, it's all the boys.
Yes. Yeah, it's very intriguing that, and the Midrash explains it by saying
I never realized
that astrologers told Pharaoh that the person who's going to save the Jewish people is going to be born just around this time. And which is true, Moses is going to be born around this time. So he didn't know whether the person who's going to save the Jewish people would be a Jew or an Egyptian. So he therefore declared that all the Egyptian boys.
But does he actually say that in here?
Yeah,
to all his people.
He gave orders to all his people.
Kol ha-bena yo'a,
all his people. It doesn't mention the astrologers. The astrologers in the middle.
No, I'm just looking at the text.
Vayetzav paro l'chol amo. We'll look at the word l'chol amo, to all his people. That means not
just
kol ben ha-yilod, every child born, not only ha-yilod la-yehudim or la-ivrim or something like that.
Yes.
But every child altogether should be thrown into the river.
I read it, or when I first glanced at this, it always sounded like that he told to his people that they should handle this situation. They should go in every... But obviously this is not what it is.
That they should go and what they... That his people should make sure the Hebrew children...
Yes, yes, yes.
That could be a possible way of understanding it. But the way the Midrash presents it is that it was something which was addressed to every single child.
Yeah.
Let's just see. Ibn Ezra sometimes gives us a dissonant view. Wait, that's in. Yeah, he doesn't. He doesn't comment on this. So that's the view from the Midrash and which Rashi accepts as the simple meaning of the text, that this really applied to everyone.
What I love about this story is the two women are the next time that we're going to do. Actually, is this daughter of a king, this princess, brings about the salvation of the Jewish people, really.
Yeah.
It came from the outside. If she hadn't taken him and into the and whatever.
Then somebody else would have.
I don't know. She does it against her father's wishes.
Yes, absolutely.
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
And the sister and this amazing Miriam. Those two
It's women. All women. It's all women. The women who refuse to kill the children, the midwives. Then there's Miriam, the sister. We'll come into more of her. The Egyptian princess. Absolutely. Yes.
And it's Rivka who does whatever she does for Jacob and Esau.
Right.
And so on. I mean, it does go on and on, doesn't it?
And here...
Look at
Sarah, who tells Abraham what to do.
Yes, very much so.
And here, you see, that's this line that Michael just read. That every boy who's born must be cast into the Nile, but every girl should be allowed to live. There's a negative sense in which every girl should be allowed to live. It's like taking control of the way the girl is, because really the girl is the key to the whole story. And so that girl has to be in with her own true sense of what it is to be a person living with a connection to the divine and to express godliness in the world. And this is what Paro wants to destroy. This is what Paro wants to destroy. And so we, with the girl, the human girl, the Jewish girl, is the real mainstay of the Jewish people.
Yeah.
And Pharaoh wants to destroy this, not by killing them, but by taking them over. Allowing them to live means they will be educated in his way. They will somehow be drawn into his way of life. And when the Rebbe was campaigning that girls should have a proper Jewish education and should study Torah and should be empowered and should be seen as the leader figures within the community and should be given that sense of empowerment. This was one of the things that he quotes to explain this idea of the significance of the girl and the woman. All right, well, we have moved a little bit along in our exploration of this book of Shemot, both as the story of the past, the birth of the Jewish people, and also the story of the present, the struggle of the individual.
Yeah.
So we have reached the birth of Moshe, which hopefully we will explore next time.
And Moshe is from Mashiti Me'amayim.
Right, the name given by the princess. Yeah.
But we don't know what he was called before.
No, that's a good point. Yes. That's a very good point.
Bye, Nigel.